Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air again with another brand new show. Last week's show, we spoke about the Galapagos, and my guest was Mickey Maxwell Cohn, a well-known naturalist, and I know a colleague that I've known for a long time, and his wife Barbara Cohn, who started the beach cleanup program, which has been going terrifically and really growing. So we're going to continue this week about talking about the Galapagos. We spoke about Darwin in the first program and how he came to a lot of his conclusions by studying the critters that were on the Galapagos Islands. And we spoke about survival and adapt. If you don't adapt to changing conditions, well, goodbye Charlie or Booby or whatever it is. So we're going to continue now and with the second program, and I'll introduce Mickey again. Mickey, say hi to everybody.
Hello, everybody, again.
Okay, and before we get into the program, I just want to wish Jack a happy birthday. It's his birthday today, and hopefully he's going to do some celebrating with his lovely girlfriend, Francesca. Right. Okay, so back to the Galapagos now, and we ended the other program talking about the boobies, which everybody loves on the Galapagos, because they really they got their name boobies because of their behavior. I think the sailors named them boobies.
I think so. That means clown,
right,
or stupid,
right,
in Spanish.
Yeah,
and it's not a word that's used very often these days, but it's an older term, and that accounts for, well, that refers back to the boobies' silly activities, quote,
right,
unquote.
Silly activities.
Yeah.
That's it.
When going through that courtship.
Yeah, but, you know, the boobies don't think it's silly.
No.
So if we call them boobies, they'll understand it because, you know, they used it, especially the courtship behavior, which a lot of birds do kind of crazy courtship behavior, like the cranes that fly up in the air and they come down.
Right.
It's a whole thing. But we must look silly to them also in our courtship behaviors because... if you look at that from that angle also. So we spoke about the blue-footed boobies, and the red-footed have similar behavior patterns?
Yes and no. The red-footed boobies have a different anatomical makeup than the other boobies in that its feet are they're clasping feet.
Okay.
You see, the blue-footed boobies cannot close his fingers like we would make a fist. So he's stuck on the ground, and his nest is on bare soil.
Right, so he can't hang out in trees too well. Then.
Not at all,
okay.
Not at all. The red-footed booby, on the other hand, which can make a fist, they call that pessarine, and it can get up into the shrubs, and it really does prefer to get up into the mangrove shrubs, which border the wet areas on many islands.
Mm-hmm.
And it gets up into those mangrove shrubs where... they can construct their nests, really full-fledged nest up there. The red-footed booby is just so magnificent when it's in full color, with
right.
that great purple and blue and reddish face, and those startling red feet.
Right, they really are a shocker.
Yeah, the red-footed booby's red feet are a startling red, as the blue-footed booby is startling blue.
Like is it like a crimson red? It really comes out at you.
Yeah, you know, there's it's an interesting thing. How did that color in both of their feet begin?
Right,
they're actually, it seems now, current science leans on the fact that those are actually metabolic byproducts, that they don't perform any real function.
Hmm.
It's just where these metabolites collect. During the course of the regular life activities of the bird.
Yeah.
Along the way, they became identification sightings, that is, secondary sex characteristics.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they have anything to do with the sexual process, other than it helps a blue-footed booby recognize another blue-footed booby.
Right.
And I don't know if any experiments have been performed with dipping a red-footed booby's feet in blue paint and seeing if they have the same survival.
If they could mate, right.
Well, that would be an interesting project.
And we would get purple boobies, purple-footed boobies, and then we could go on from there. Well, if it hasn't been done yet, I'm sure that, you know, one of these days, we'll somebody will try and do research and, you know.
Well, I'd like to get in on that project.
Purple-footed boobies.
Right.
Okay, some of the other birds that I remember, the frigate bird was really an impressive bird. I know it's a predator.
Yes.
But can you tell people about that name, frigate bird, how they got it?
Well, frigate actually comes from fregata, a Spanish word, which means fight. And that word is now an international word. It's many, many other words have stemmed from that. For example, British warships have been called frigates since that time. American warships are also called frigates, man of war. Mm-hmm. And so this particular bird, which is a wild fighting bird, a man of war would be a great American name or an English name for it, and it is sometimes called man of war bird. But frigate or fregata in Spanish, they're all perfectly appropriate for this organism that really is a pirate and a fighter, a battler, and it is what we call in ecological terms a parasitic feeder.
Mm-hmm.
That is, for the most part, the food that it takes is taken in a pirate-like manner from other birds. Now let's just get a little example of how this is going. I use as an example a red-billed tropic bird. One of my favorite birds. It's a beautiful white bird, a nocturnal feeder, long flowing tail. Everybody loves it. It's just such a beautiful creature. But it's disadvantaged. It was born with a terrible feeding need. It flies way out to sea, away from its breeding places on the Galapagos Islands. So it flies out maybe 70 miles out to sea, where it feeds on small shrimps and other small fishes, anchovies and so on. And on its way back with a full gut to feed its offspring, on its way back, it will be spotted by a frigate bird, which comes in and harasses it, comes diving down on it, doesn't do it any physical damage. But the frigate bird, with its extraordinary maneuverability. See, it has a forked tail.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, much more forked than a swallow.
Yeah,
has.
They're like fighter planes. They're so maneuverable,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, exactly. Mm-hmm. If you hold your arms out, arm's length, and you move your arms up and down, you know, alternating with one another, you get the idea of how that bird manipulates its tail feathers, enabling it to do barrel rolls, to do spirals and twists, inside rolls, outside rolls. It's just, like you say, a modern fighter bird.
Yeah, that's why I think they call it the magnificent frigate bird.
Well,
because to see it flying, it's magnificent.
Absolutely. Well, so is the other one. But yeah, also, the magnificent has a green sheen on the male, making him a really, really beautiful specimen.
Okay.
However, he dives down on let's say a tropic bird, and it so upsets the tropic bird that he drops the food in midair. The booby now does a barrel roll. It comes down and it catches that food midair and it eats the food.
Right, right.
Poor, poor tropic bird has to make a U-turn and go on back and start feeding all over again. So it's a predator. It will also come down when it's flying around the islands itself. It can come down, and if there's any protected baby, like out on some of the reptile breeding grounds, if an iguana has to leave its nest and go down into the water to feed, leaves its nest unprotected, that's the time that the frigate bird will swoop down and pick up one of those baby iguanas. Or if a tortoise, a turtle, Pacific green turtles nest on those grounds, when those eggs hatch out and en masse the baby turtles are running back into the sea, that's just the time when the frigate birds will swoop down over that group and eat them one by one in rapid succession, wipe out the whole population.
So that's why they're called parasitic.
Parasitic, yes.
They prey on these other birds and other stuff.
Exactly.
I know the eagle does some of that too, but not as bad.
The eagle doesn't have the best reputation,
does it? Yes, that's right. I've seen it swoop down on an osprey. and harass the osprey to drop the fish.
Yes,
you know?
Yeah.
But he doesn't have, the frigate bird is really the master pirate.
Out there in the Galapagos Island, it could have been called the pirate bird also.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, okay. And it's always all other birds and animals that are nursing or taking care of their offspring have to be very, very much aware of the frigate bird.
Yeah.
Since we don't usually side, our human emotions favor the victim. it's nice for tourists to know, to keep in mind, that frigate birds have their problems too. Here they are, they're seabirds. But unlike most seabirds, they cannot shed water.
Okay.
If once they land on the water,
they're done.
And get wet. Uh-huh. They cannot take off again. They're doomed.
Is it? What about the albatrosses? Do they have the same problem?
No. Albatrosses can make it off the water.
They can make it off.
Yeah,
okay.
They can stay out all year long and occasionally coming down on the water to pick some food off the surface.
Mm.
But they sit
like ducks sometimes on the water.
Yeah. They have a hard time taking off, though, because they're heavy birds.
Heavy birds, right.
And they need a good headwind
for
a successful takeoff. Mm-hmm. But eventually they can make it.
Yeah.
Frigate birds, I've seen them many, many times on the surface of the water. I've never seen one able to take off.
Take off again. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So they have to stay aloft and not come down. Right?
Yes, indeed.
But they're beautiful to see when they're in their nesting phase. They have what do you call that? It's like a big breast that comes out.
Well, it's actually a throat pouch.
Throat pouch, that's the word, right.
The term that they use in birding is gular pouch.
Gular pouch,
throat
right.
pouch. Now, normally, the male who has this throat pouch doesn't exhibit it. You're not even aware that it's there. However, during the mating season, it becomes somewhat inflated and it dangles, so you can spot it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's when it actually becomes sexually inspired that he pumps it full of air and it blows up like a great balloon.
Right. Okay.
And that balloon is very attractive to the females. So the male frigate bird will sit out on the branches, usually of a low shrub, like mangrove shrubs.
Yeah.
And he'll spread his wings, and when he sees a female flying overhead, easily recognizable because she has a large white throat and white breast. And so it's like a advertising sign.
Right.
And he sees her, and he waves his wings back and forth while he's firmly perched to the shrub.
Mm.
But those wings go back and forth and they quiver and he calls out and he's like saying, ooh, 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 while these wings are shaking and he's moving his head back and forth and this inflated balloon is rocking back and forth, left and right. Very, very impressive.
It's very impressive, sure.
And if she's turned on by this, she will circle a few times and come down, join him, and help him to continue building the nest that he started.
Mm-hmm.
They will mate, and together they will look over the offspring. They have to nurse that offspring, take care of it for a year before it becomes independent.
Before it could fly, they fledge.
Well, it could fly a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Some months after it's born, it can even join them on hunting trips. But to learn all those maneuvers and to learn how to steal food from other birds, to learn to come down picking up food from the surface of the sea without getting wetted and therefore killing itself, that takes a year or so of practice.
Basic training. Right.
So it's a long commitment to your family.
Yeah. So that's just a few of the birds that we have time to talk about. But Mickey has put up those great pictures on the site. And there's probably one of the frigate bird with its gullet expanded.
Yes.
What was that word again, Mick?
Yeah, gular.
Gular.
G-U-L-A-R, gular pouch.
Gular pouch.
Let's say throat pouch.
Throat pouch, yeah. And it's really impressive. It's there's crimson red also. And if you go to the Galapagos Islands, it's amazing. You can walk right up to where they're sitting on their nest and It doesn't bother them.
Again, you don't need a telephoto lens to take a picture.
It's a great place for nature photography. So the other critters on the Galapagos that are really unique also are the marine iguanas. Are they any other place, Mickey, or are they just endemic there now?
No, this is the only marine reptile, no, I shouldn't say reptile, the only marine lizard in the world.
Right.
It's the only lizard that feeds in salt water in the world. And Darwin has a wonderful, wonderful explanation for that. which encompasses the essence of his theory of natural selection. So let's go over that, okay?
Sure.
So here are some green iguanas occupying Central America all the way down into well into South America.
Sure. If you've been to the tropics, you've seen iguanas. South Florida, you can see iguanas. Sure.
Yes, they like to go up in trees, right. Often in public parks.
Right, and just hang out.
Where they'll come down and they'll feed you. You know, you can leave out some food for them. And they'll,
part so of the, your lunch, these are just
down.
Terrestrial. They don't have anything to do with the water.
Well, drink. They get along in fresh water.
They can swim all right.
Yeah. They swim all right, but no, they cannot tolerate salt water. Right. Their kidneys are not capable of metabolizing salt water at all. However, along the way, as we mentioned last show, along the way, some of those iguanas apparently found themselves clinging to debris that washed out of South American rivers during flood time and floated across 600 miles of sea gap. Found themselves on the Galapagos Islands. It could have happened again and again and again. However, they did not find choice food, the kind of delicate food that they were accustomed to in Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
And so certainly most of them died off. However, along the way, an iguana or a couple of them carried an infection with them. Not a serious infection. Just like you and I have in our intestines, a certain number of bacteria and yeast and protozoa, not doing any particular damage to us, maybe even helping us. Some green iguana in the past came with a kind of bacteria that many, many other animals have in their systems. Let me just digress for a brief moment, and I'll get back to the iguana story. Termites eat wood, but they cannot digest wood.
They need the bacteria.
The bacteria in their gut changes the cellulose of the wood into the other carbohydrates, sugars, that they need for survival. Otherwise, they would die of malnutrition, indigestion.
Right.
Same thing with these green iguanas having arrived. If they ate the land food that they could accommodate to, they might survive for a while. But along the way, some arrived with this infection of that kind of bacteria. And they found that they were able to digest cellulose to a much higher degree, particularly the cellulose found in a green seaweed growing right on the shore and just offshore. And those iguanas became adapted in many different ways for our life on the rocks above the shore and for feeding in the shore.
And under the water.
And under the water, down to 60 feet deep. Right. And they can stay submerged for 15 minutes at a time, utilizing stored up oxygen before they have to come back up. And those bacteria are digesting the seaweeds that they're eating, changing the seaweeds into other carbohydrates that they will digest when they're on land.
So they found a brand new source of food that they don't have to compete with any other critters, really, for that.
Yeah, they found a brand new source of food.
Right.
In the terms of the ecologist,
they
exploited a new food resource.
Right.
Yeah.
They expanded their niche.
Yeah.
They found a new niche.
Hey, great. Okay.
A new niche,
yes,
okay.
As the British say.
So we're going to stop and take a break. But before we do, remember now this is the Naturalist Program, and my guests today are Mickey and Barbara Cohn. And we'll be back in a minute to tell the rest of the story about the marine iguanas, and you could dive and see them in the Galapagos.
Still be back on the
I know you a long time. Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air. We took a short break to have a drink of water, and I'm back with my one of my favorite people, Mickey Cohen, and Maxwell. Your name was Maxwell, wasn't it, originally?
Yes.
But everybody calls you Mickey.
Mickey, yeah.
Your mother probably called you Maxwell.
Yes.
Yeah,
probably. For a little while until Mickey stepped into the picture.
So Mickey and Barbara Cohen, and we were talking about the marine iguanas, which are unique to the earth, I guess. It's the only place you can really find them is on Galapagos Island.
The only place,
so
yes.
So when they probably arrived on a raft, debris that washed out from the mainland, and they weren't marine iguanas when they started out, but they've adopted. And Mickey just gave us a great description, and Darwin talks about that too, how they've adapted to their new home. And Mickey, let's just stress that if people go to the Galapagos, you can go snorkeling, and you could actually swim with the marine iguanas. You can see them diving into the water, going down and grabbing the seaweed, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have that, if you're lucky enough to do what Bernie just described, I hope you can remember the following. When you're down in the water and you swim up to the marine iguanas and you see them grazing on the algae, on the seaweeds, notice how their teeth are perfectly adapted, shaped, to scrape that algae off, unlike other iguanas, which have the ability to open their mouths wide. They have a high arch in their dentition. Mm. In the marine iguana, the teeth are all lined up in the front, sort of from ear to ear. So when they come up nose to nose with the algae clinging to the rocks, those front teeth can scrape the algae right off the rocks. If they had the arch of their ancestors, they would be unable to
do that.
Effectively do that.
So they have adapted.
Yeah, many different adaptations.
Yeah, also to deal with the salt.
Oh, the salt, of course, because they're taking in a huge amount of salt
with their food.
So of course, most animals handle their salt, get rid of excess salt through their kidneys.
Right.
In the case of the marine iguana, there's another salt excreting gland right up there behind the nose.
Right.
And people who visit, now you've got to watch this, folks, when you go to the Galapagos, and I hope that's very soon, stare at a particular iguana when he's up on land, and they do come up on land, stare at it, and you'll notice that every once in a while it blows its nose, and out comes a fountain of mucus. It's actually salt.
Looks like it has a cold.
But it's concentrated salt.
That's the
brine
salt. Right.
That comes out of the nose. That's its technique of getting rid of the salt that would otherwise build up and poison its whole system.
Yeah, so like a lot of the seabirds do the same thing.
Yeah.
Are they the tuber nose birds that have this gland right on their beak?
Yes.
To excrete the salt.
That's right.
Yeah, yes. So a lot of critters have that, but it's especially interesting the iguanas.
Yeah.
Because we know not too long ago they were just terrestrial.
Yeah.
When I say not too long ago, maybe a million years ago, but that's not too long ago.
Yeah.
In the geological time.
Yeah. As soon as the iguanas sense that it's getting too cold for them, they come back up on land again. And it's a very interesting thing. You'll see this on one of the pictures. The iguanas all line themselves up in strict order with their sides facing the sun. That is allowing more surface area to face the warming sun. They're colored black, not for protection. They're colored black because that absorbs greater heat.
Right.
And so lying out there in the sun, the heat that they lost will be regenerated. And that's extremely important to their survival because the bacteria that they harbor function at an optimal temperature of some 90 degrees.
Ah, so they need all that heat.
Well, these are cold-blooded animals.
That's right.
So they need to have a source of heat to allow the bacteria to continue the digestive process for them.
Right. So remember, folks, that we are warm-blooded animals. So we produce our own heat. But critters like the iguana, they are cold-blooded, as we say, and they have to depend on the sun to keep them warm. Mm-hmm. That's why they're living on this nice warm climate.
Yeah.
And they could be marine.
Yes.
And also, the waters there are not that warm. I remember when we were diving, it was like 70 degrees or something.
Oh, even colder than
colder
that,
than
right?
That,
yes. It depends upon the season, of course. But during our summer,
Yeah.
The islands are bathed by that cold water coming up from far south.
From Antarctica.
Yes, yes.
Is that the continuation of the Humboldt Current?
It is, yes. Humboldt Current and Peru Current are very closely related.
Right. They probably swing out west, I guess. They come up the coast and then they swing out west.
Yes, yeah. And they bathe the islands during our winter months.
Yes, and that brings us up another critter, the penguin, which is very unusual. Here's a penguin living just about near the equator.
Yeah.
And there are no penguins north of the equator because the equator and the tropics are a thermal barrier to penguins. They can't take that hot weather. But here's this penguin surviving there because of this cold water current. Is that right, Mick?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Yeah.
They came up from the Antarctic, or at least from far South America.
Right.
They came up from cold water areas where their ancestors lived and have flourished for a long, long time. But, you know, there's a great diaspora among living things. There's always this tendency for them to spread out.
Right.
And if they're lucky, they can conquer new territories. If they're not, and the vast majority are not that lucky, they succumb. That's the nature of evolution. And so here, penguins moved on up north, and those that ended up on this with the cold, they came up with the cold
currents. Yeah,
and those that ended up on the south coasts of some of the islands managed to survive. Why the south coast? Those are the edges of the islands that are still bathed by the cold water.
The cold currents, right?
You will never, never find them on the northern beaches of any of the islands.
Yep.
And as you say, they are the northernmost penguins. Also, they are the smallest of the penguins.
Oh, yes, they're tiny again.
Yeah,
right.
They're tiny. That's an adaptation for survival on these islands because they are limited somewhat to the amount of food that they can find, and that favors being small.
Right.
And so the large emperor penguin could, even if it could adapt to the relatively warm water, it could not feed itself enough to stay alive.
No, because the penguins need a huge amount of fish and krill.
Yes.
And they'll only find it in that cold current.
Yeah.
Once they get out of the cold current, there's not those huge schools of fish in the area.
Yeah. Bern, when you were in the Galapagos that time, were you able to swim with the penguins also near Bartholomew Island?
No, I remember seeing them. We boated up in one of the little skiffs.
Yeah.
And we saw them there, but we didn't swim with them.
Yeah.
We swam with the the iguanas and the seals.
Right, of course, yes.
Sea lions, I
guess. Sea lions.
Yeah, eared seals, sea lions.
Yes.
But
the reason I ask is because some groups are lucky enough to be able to actually be on the shore of southern shore of an island at the time that the penguins are feeding, and you can actually snorkel among them.
Yeah, that would be fun.
And they swim so fast, they come like little bathtub toys,
right?
And their little feet are like the propeller on a bathtub toy, and then you swim right out.
They're great swimmers. And by the way, in Central Park Zoo, there's a great penguin exhibit. I don't know if you've seen it, but I tell everybody about it. If they're visiting the city, go to the Central Park Zoo, which is right in the middle of Manhattan. And the penguin exhibit is great because you're at eye level and you're under the water.
Yes.
You're right below the surface of the water, and you see how beautiful they are, you know, swimming in the water.
Yeah. I gestured no to you just now, but I remember that Barbara and I visited there not so long ago. How did I forget?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, what the hell? You know, can't remember everything as we're finding out as we get older, right? Okay. So that's good. So, Jack, how much time do we have left? Okay, about 5 minutes left. So, Mickey, let's talk about people and the Galapagos and the future of the islands, and are they well protected and all that stuff?
Okay. Yeah, Bernie, I'm happy to let you know that they are magnificently protected.
Oh, that's good to
hear.
There's
the Charles Darwin Foundation that accepts your donations very graciously and will support the laboratories and the National Park Service there. That will patrol the islands and see to it that everything is maintained as wonderfully as possible. But that possible is a...
yes.
There
right.
you have a keyword. It's sometimes impossible to control that place. And I'll just give you an example. Tourism is also a source of great fundraising.
Mm.
And they need the tourist dollars to keep that whole project going. However, tourists used to be limited to 15,000 tourists per year.
Mm-hmm.
They could easily control that because there are only a certain number of vessels that are licensed.
Right, to get the licenses, yeah.
And it was then, and it would go up every couple of years to 15,000 and then 30,000 and then 60,000. And now, when I was there last in 2007, there were 60,000 tourists that year.
Mm.
It now, this year, there will be 100,000 tourists visiting the islands. And I've always said that the tourists being very, very cooperative and very much controlled, and they stick to designated trails.
Right.
They have created no major problems, but yes, they have now. And this is the reason. Not because they're disrespectful of the environment, but because the tourists demand certain services. Even if they're on vessels, they require a great amount of food that has to be transported to the islands and delivered to the tourist vessels.
Mm-hmm.
Or they're staying in accommodations on shore, and the restaurants in those motels have to be supplied. There's a great amount of garbage produced. All that garbage has to be collected and packaged up and removed from the islands and carried back to the mainland, because while we were in a different mode of discarding that at local dumps on the islands, it was when we were only 30,000 tourists a year, that would be feasible.
Mm-hmm.
But now with all the additional tourists and the demand for fresh linens every day on the boats.
Mm-hmm.
And now when they go out on land, they take towels with them to dry out when they come in from a swim or a snorkel trip. All these demands are putting pressures on the islands that we haven't had before.
Yeah.
That means that we have to also allow a greater number of Ecuadorians to come out to the islands and establish a place to live.
Because they need the workers there.
Prior to this, you can't keep them out. But who wanted to come out to the Galapagos Islands?
Yeah.
But it's a province. And they have as much right to come out to the islands as we have to go visiting Alaska or Hawaii. And so it presents new problems with all the new native people from Ecuador coming out to the islands, and they're coming out to farm also, because mm-hmm. there's a demand for fresh fruit and vegetables.
Right.
Now, farmers are hard put to leave their, to come in without accompanying mice, rats,
sure.
cats, dogs, other animals that they would want to keep on their farm, ducks, donkeys, horses.
And brother-in-laws.
Yeah.
The family wants to come out too.
And they're all raising big families out there. So the farming communities are now expanding far beyond the capability of these little private enclaves on some of the islands to support them
mm-hmm.
in a controlled manner. Another great, great threat to us is the fact that some years ago, the Japanese, who have a great love for seafood, discovered that there was an almost unlimited source of seafood in the waters around the Galapagos Islands. That's called a marine reserve.
Mm-hmm.
Several miles of surrounding waters are off limits to commercial fishing.
Right.
However, just outside that 12-mile limit, the Japanese found that they could hire locals living on the islands to dive for sea cucumbers. They're called pepinos.
Uh-huh.
The sea cucumbers are shipped back to Japan, where they are hollowed out and leaving. It's like it looks like a cucumber.
Right, it does. Yeah.
But all the seeds inside come out when you hit them and you spank them or you just jostle them. They evert their innards, leaving a hollow tube.
Right.
In life, that would be regenerated.
Right.
But before it could be regenerated, it would be stuffed with all kinds of meats and seafood and herbs and fried or cooked or deep fried, prepared in various ways, and served as a Japanese delicacy.
Yeah.
Pepinos is a wonderful delicacy.
Mm.
But the demand for it grew so much that the Japanese fisheries then brought out advanced fishing equipment for the Ecuadorians to use. Nets that would extend to the very bottom, and they would drag the bottom drag to these along, pepinos.
Destroy everything on the
and
process.
Everything would come up in the nest. At first, the locals were picking the pepinos out and dumping everything back. But when the fisheries industry discovered that there was all this other stuff down there that had commercial value, they then told the fishermen, don't cull that stuff. Don't throw the bad stuff back. Bring everything out to the factory ships parked offshore to accommodate, and they will take that from you by the barrel load and let them go through it.
So they're really cleaning out the ecosystem.
They're scraping the bottom clean, and that's very difficult to control in the international waters. And unfortunately, illegally, they extend themselves into the local waters, and it's very difficult with such a large area to patrol the waters and get the fishermen back into the international waters outside.
Sure.
So I worry very much about the ability of the local waters to continue to feed the seabirds that we've been talking about.
Right, they go out to sea to get a good meal.
Yeah, exactly.
So there are problems.
So it's a great place. It's still paradise. Right. But I worry very much about the future. I stay awake at night thinking about it.
Yeah. So we'll end on a positive note, though, that you should still go there as a tourist.
Definitely.
Because that part is very well controlled.
Oh, yes.
And the local guides are terrific. I remember those great guides that we had.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go, I would recommend you go on a small ship.
Yes.
Because the small ships are more maneuverable. And they'll get you closer into the beaches, and some of the big ships, which have hundreds of people, you have to wait for everybody to get on and off the ship.
I agree with you, 100%.
Right? So when I went with Mickey, we had a ship that had 16 people. It was perfect, and it was a great trip. So I want to thank you, Mickey and Barbara, for coming down today to Bushwick through the horrible weather, which is fine today. The sun is shining. Yeah. And this is the Naturalist signing off, and Mickey.
Okay. Adios, everybody. Thank you for joining us.
All right.